evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Even beginning with myself, we'll declare our assets and want to make sure that this is well known. The purpose of coming to government to know that it's public service, and if you are not ready to serve the public, you can go elsewhere.
Liberia's president-elect plans to declare his assets in the effort to weed out corruption.
But as far as I'm concerned, I have discharged my responsibilities with honor, and because I don't have a marking guide, which can declare me as having flunked the exam, so I have no reason to really debate the skewed views that are not backed by facts from my detractors.
Uganda opposition in parliament changes leadership.
The elections are about ensuring that there is transparency, there is fairness. But if we have to take the route where we do not take part in the registration, then there will not be any fairness.
And Botswana's main opposition party warns lack of transparency in the voter registration process will undermine the integrity of next year's general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Liberia's president-elect says he plans to declare his assets as part of the effort to weed out corruption. Joseph Boakai says he also plans to institute a measure to ensure transparency and accountability in his administration's fight to eliminate financial malfeasance and wrongdoing. This, he says, he plans to do by working with international partners to audit the government and the outgoing administration. His remarks follow an exclusive interview at the VOA studios in Washington. The Electoral Commission of Liberia declared Boakai winner of the recent presidential runoff after defeating incumbent President George Weah. For more information about the fight to weed out graft in Liberia, I had a sit-down interview with President-elect Joseph Boakai. Here is part one of the conversation.
We came as a rescue mission, and we know one of the biggest problems there is corruption. And I want to say that we start by making sure those people that we bring to cabinet are people of integrity. And secondly, I want to make sure that even beginning with myself, we'll declare our assets and want to make sure that this is well known. The purpose of coming to government to know that it's public service, and if you are not ready to serve the public, you can go elsewhere. But we want to make sure that we start on a clear note that the people of our country stood on line, they protected the votes, not to bring a team again that will do the same thing that the other people are doing or worse.
Mr. President-elect, you talked about asset declaration starting from yourself and the people who work with you, as well as the outgoing administration. How do you plan to avoid the semblance of targeting people? Because some people will say these are politically motivated to tarnish their reputation or to go against them, people from certain tribes or specific parts of the country. How do you plan to avoid this?
We are aware of that. And when we talk about auditing, it's not going to be a Liberian auditing. We want to make sure that our international partners work with us for a public tender, for competent and renowned auditing firm that will be qualified at an international level to make sure they come on board to do that. We are aware of people saying witch hunting, witch hunting. But I don't think it's witch hunting when you have to account for your stewardship, but it has to be done in a way that is well-established, entity with reputation, to make sure that it audits and make sure that it reports to the public the findings.
Assuming allies of yours, family members of yours, are accused of corruption during your administration, Mr. President-elect, how do you plan to tackle this specifically?
I come to work not with friendship. I have friends, But there is a clear line of demarcation between friendship, family, and managing. With the experience that we come with a country that celebrates 176 years, and with the life of our people living below the poverty line, I don't think we come into government again to start talking about our family, to start talking about. I think we come there to make sure that we give the Liberian people hope, and I'm committed to that.
During the campaigning, you talked a lot about the country's youth, who are the majority of the population.
Yes.
What plans do you have for the people of Liberia?
First, we have a platform, and then we have an abridged platform that talks about arrest, meaning agriculture, roads, the rule of law, education, sanitation, and tourism. We believe these are areas in which we can jumpstart. And in those areas, we believe that our young people who are in the majority, they need to be equipped. We need to open opportunities for them to be trained and be marketable. But to do this, we have to be able to impress our partners and investors, the private sector investment, to make them feel that we are here for business, and this business, their investment will impact the young people, but the young people need to be trained. And we know that there are things that we can jumpstart that could bring little relief to the public. There are a lot of areas in which we can begin to alleviate the suffering of the people. We're going to examine those areas, like where we know that the prices of commodities, essential commodities like rice and things, where we know that there have been some tariffs that we can work with right away. But I have said that in the first 100 days, no car will get stuck in the mud.
Joseph Boakai is Liberia's president-elect. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Join us on Sunday for part two of the conversation.
In the DRC, the leader of the Union of Young Progressives in Solidarity Party says the Electoral Commission appeared not fully prepared in organizing the just-ended December 20 general election. Due to logistical challenges, the election was extended for an additional day. Isaac Akili Beamungu, who stood as a parliamentary candidate in the North Kivu province, says there were not enough voting machines to handle the overwhelming number of voters in his constituency. This prompted five opposition presidential candidates, including Nobel laureate Dr. Denis Mukwege and Martin Fayulu, to demand as a rerun of the polls. This as the Independent National Electoral Commission, or CNE, begins to release the results of the presidential contest. The outcome of the parliamentary elections is scheduled to be released on December 31. For more about the elections, I reach parliamentary candidate Isaac Akili Bayamungu.
The parliamentary result will be starting come out on 31. So it will be on the next Tuesday at night.
What have you observed about the elections as a parliamentary candidate in North Kivu?
As a candidate, I can say that the election was organized, yes, but the logistic was very, very, very meaningless. It means the CENI didn't have any aircraft to start deploying all the materials for the vote. So they had used, I don't know which kind of ways. So that's what makes things to be delayed, started very late, because in one office was containing three machines for voting. But this one, only one machine for a voting room, which contains more than 1,000 people. So impossible for them to vote and finish a day. That was the first observation. But the second observation, there is a lot of these old MPs who was trying to corrupt the people, giving people money, then they can vote for them. And the police could not be able to stop those kind of maneuver of those old politicians, which actually want to win by force, by anyhow.
But Isaac, a lot of people say that is how Congolese are used to vote for these
petitions. I don't think so.
Why are you complaining about it?
I don't think so because I'm a Congolese and I'm a candidate. I never give tips to me to be voted. You know, the big challenge in Congo in Africa, the politicians are not acting for development, but they are acting for their only way of gaining the power, and they don't care with the population. And those who behaving so, they cannot only pay money for people to be voted, but those who are very close to the population, working for the population, working for the peace around the DRC, working for the development of the social economic of population, cannot give money or pay any money for them to be voted by their population.
What do you say to your critics who say that you are kicking against those who are giving out money because you don't have money to give? That is why you are complaining, and that if you have money, you would have done the same.
No, I can't say that I don't have money, but my money is not to be used for corruption. But my money can develop the sector around my population. My money there to organize my population for any kind of development. You know, I'm working around Goma for what we call microfinancing. We give money for those population who doesn't have work so they can organize themselves, their small work, small business, but not go on the site of vote and start sharing money there for people to vote the candidate. Now, there is many way to help the population, but not go and buy the vote.
Based on what you have done for your people, do you think they will elect you as their next member of parliament in North Kivu?
100% sure, because I had been turning around the town of Goma, where the population had voted and where all the results, some results had already out. So I can see how many numbers had gotten for vote. But the challenge is, as you can see even on the internet, there is even some member of parliament, the parliament which is finishing this year, they had already hired even a machine and started voting themselves in their house and come at the sites just depositing the votes who they had already did. So at that side, we can say there is some small problem.
Isaac Akili Bayamungu is a parliamentary candidate in the DRC elections. He spoke with me from Goma in North Kivu. In Uganda, attorney Mathias Mpuuga, the leader of the opposition from the National Unity Platform, or NUP, in parliament, has been replaced. Joel Senyonyi, a spokesperson for the party, assumes the position of opposition leader in the lawmaking body. Announcing the changes, the leader of the party, Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly called Bobi Wine, named Mpuuga as commissioner in parliament. But critics say the replacement of Mpuuga is a significant demotion, an assertion the NUP denies. For the latest development and what the new changes mean, I reach attorney Mathias Mpuuga.
Well, the Constitution and the Administration of Parliament Act puts in place commissioners. Parliament is run by a parliamentary commission. The commission administers parliament. So for every term of parliament, we have what we call four backbench commissioners. The party in power presents three and the opposition presents one. The duty of the commission is to take care of the management, welfare of parliament in its entirety and members of parliament in general. So that's now the task I'm charged with facilitating committees of parliament work and all offices that are charged with doing political work and other work of parliament. That's where my party has deployed me.
Your critics are saying this is a demotion because they think you have not been effective as the leader of the opposition in parliament.
Indeed, I have immense respect for the views of the detractors. But until they provide a marking guide for which I is franked, then we can hold their views valid. Otherwise, for me, it remains noise. A political party can variously deploy its cadership at any one time to achieve a particular objective. And the question of 2.5 years will be able having good life around, be able to witness what that would herald for this young party. But as far as I'm concerned, I have discharged my responsibilities with honor, and because I don't have a marking guide, which can declare me as having flunked the exam, so I have no reason to really debate the skewed views that are not backed by facts from my detractors.
When I said to people I was going to talk to you, they wanted to find out whether your experience as a lawyer and as a parliamentarian will be extended to helping the young ones who are coming in terms of parliamentary work.
Exactly. That's part of what I have been doing over the last 3 years. Every turn of election, the Ghanaian parliament has already had a turnover of over 85%, meaning that at every turn, you have 85% new members of parliament, and most of them young people, first-timers, first job without any public service experience. And I have expended a lot of time and energy training and orienting and technically backstopping these young legislators. It's something I intend to continue to do, because this work of building a new Uganda is not an event. It's a marathon over which a series of activities must be undertaken, and invariably training of the leaders of today and tomorrow, including mobilization and identifying and training new ones, will be a key preoccupation on my part.
With your new deployment in Parliament as a commissioner, does that mean that you still hold your position as the vice president of the NUP?
Certainly. I am still the deputy president of NUP in charge of Uganda region, which is the central part of Uganda, the most populous part of Uganda, in which NUP had almost an 80% presidential victory in the last election. So that remains unchanged.
What is your message to the people of Uganda as you move to this new role?
Certainly, invitation is to the people of Uganda is to give the new leadership a chance to exercise their wits. I am very sure they have ideas they want to be implemented. They should be given a chance. They should be tested. And therefore, they should be afforded the same support that have been afforded over the last 2.5 years, because what they are doing is not for themselves, not for their families, but for the people of Uganda, for posterity, in a bid to see a new and better Uganda. They deserve support. And I'll lead from the front in ensuring that they execute and fulfill their mandate.
Attorney Mathias Mpuuga is the Commissioner of Parliament from the Opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Still in Uganda, lawyers for and against the Anti-Homosexuality Act are waiting on the judges of the Supreme Court to make a decision on the legality of the law. It comes after a 5-member panel of judges accepted written submissions from the two main parties about the measure recently signed into law by President Yoweri Museveni. This following a unanimous approval by Parliament. The anti-homosexuality law makes same-sex relations illegal, and the punishment includes up to 10 years in prison for those who describe themselves as LGBTQ. But human rights defenders, lawyers, lecturers, and LGBTQ activists contend the law contravenes the Constitution. Nicholas Opio is the lead attorney challenging the law. He tells me he expects the judges to make a ruling before the end of the year due to what he says is the enormity of the law and its impact on the country.
The court, in its wisdom, decided that the petitions filed by different parties before it would be decided by way of written submission. And so all the lawyers have filed their reasoning. The people who are challenging the law and those who are defending the law, as well as the amicus or friends of court, have all filed their written reasoning to the court. The court has told us that they will notify us when they are ready. So the judges have retired to write their judgments, to consider the arguments that the parties have presented. And when they arrive at a decision, they will send us a notice of judgment. We don't know when that will be. Our expectation is that given the gravity of this matter, its impact on the country, but more importantly, its impact on the life of the country's sexual minority, the court will give us a ruling before the end of the year.
Nicholas, as a lead lawyer, what is your core concern or core challenge of this law?
It boils down really to one sentence, and that is the court will have to decide whether every Ugandan, including people of different sexual orientation and gender identity, enjoy the equal protection of the law of the Ugandan constitution. That really is the essence of our argument, that the court must decide whether certain Ugandans who have a different sexual orientation enjoy the same right and protection of the law like everybody else in the Ugandan community. But the particular legal arguments that underpin that broad sentence is really that the Anti-Homosexuality Act in its entirety contravenes several rights in the Bill of Rights in our Constitution. The second thing is that many people think that the Anti-Homosexuality Act is only about LGBT folk. Nothing could be further from the truth. Doctors, teachers, landlords, and everybody else in this country is impacted by the law, insofar as the law creates a mandatory reporting obligation on anybody who has suspicion or who knows anybody who is involved in same-sex relation to report. Failure to report would make you a criminal who would get you sentenced to jail.
But Nicholas, what do you say to those who are of the opinion that majority of Ugandans are in support of the law because the law, they said, aims to protect the young ones who are defenseless?
Laws are made to protect not the wishes of majority, but the very weakest in our society from majority tyranny. That is the essence of the protection of law. The law is not a tool of the majority to trample upon everybody. It is to protect unpopular opinions and views and expressions. That is the essence of legal protection. And I think that first and foremost, Uganda must realize that obligation, that a very small sexual minority is now up against the tyranny of majority, a vast majority that is really, I think, whipped up, mainly based on misinformation. The biggest sexual offenders to children in this country is not the LGBTI, it is heterosexual folks. There's government statistics showing that sexual violence and exploitation against children is predominant and heterosexual offense. Using this law to whip sexual majority in the guise of protecting children is really a dog whistle.
Critics of those who are challenging the law, including lawyers like you, is that you are doing this to appease your benefactors abroad, who are, they said, are bent on negatively influencing the Ugandan society by introducing something that they said is alien and unnatural in Uganda. Your thoughts?
My clients are not foreigners. The people that I represent in that court are Ugandan. Ugandan transgender individuals, Ugandan lesbian individuals, Ugandan queer individuals. They are as Ugandan as they get, many of whom are destitute and have never left this country. These people are not foreigners. Sexual expression in our communities have never been monolithic. There have been multiple forms of sexual expression, gender identity. Those who argue that this is foreign do not understand our history, our cultural mythology, and had better look harder. And they will find that in African communities, certainly in the Ugandan context, before the contact with the global West, we had sexual expressions that were different from the normative sexual expression that we know.
Nicholas Opiyo is the lead attorney challenging the Anti-Homosexuality Act. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
On this week's Issues in the News, as the world calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, warnings of potential famine as the humanitarian crisis becomes unsustainable. We'll hear from a Middle East expert about what's happening on the ground and what he fears could come ahead of an agreement. And a deep dive into Pope Francis's end-of-year shift on blessing same-sex couples. Join us this weekend for Issues in the News.
In Botswana, the main opposition umbrella Democratic Change, or UDC, says a court ruling that prevents its representatives from monitoring voter registration will undermine the transparency and credibility of next year's general election. This after the Court of Appeal ruled that representatives of the UDC will no longer be allowed to monitor the process. A high court had earlier allowed the opposition party to monitor the process, but the Independent Electoral Commission appealed the ruling. Opposition and civil society have expressed concern about the electoral body's pushback against efforts by political parties and other stakeholders to monitor voter registration as it compiles a list to be used for the elections. Moeti Mowasa is the spokesperson for the opposition UDC. He tells me that the party will appeal the ruling, contending that the appeals court got it wrong when it decided to prevent groups from monitoring the voter compilation process.
In the 2019 general elections, we went to court because we were not happy with how the elections were run. On election day, the voters' roll that was used, there was not the one that we had the seal from the IEC. We are going back to the High Court to deal with the main application and argue our case, because we believe we have a strong case. We respect the independence of the judiciary, but we believe that the Apex Court erred. Primarily, elections are about ensuring that there is transparency, there is fairness. But if we have to take the route where we do not take part in the registration, then there will not be any fairness. You know, we had instances in the past where you had registration officers from the IEC, because the law says that for one to register, that person has to register, has to present itself or herself at the polling station. So we had a situation in the past where we had people who registered without necessarily presenting themselves at the polling station, because the registration clerks were working to register people after hours.
I understand some of your party members are saying that the ruling could mean that there would be lack of transparency and accountability in the voter registration process to ensure credibility of next year's election.
That is true. I mean, if you want to have credible elections, what you need to do is make sure that the participants have access to all the necessary information that is there, and also make sure that they have a role to play in the whole exercise. Basically, what we are saying is that let us be transparent, so that ultimately whoever wins will have become victorious from a very transparent and open process.
Are you going to engage the Independent Electoral Commission to address this concern despite the ongoing court challenge?
We have raised these issues. Like I mentioned, we wrote a letter to the IEC raising these issues with them, and then they also give us an undertaking that they will make sure that the allegations that we have raised are not repeated. But the issue here is that the IEC, as it is right now, cannot be trusted. I mean, who would trust an organization that does not believe in transparency? Because where we are right now is it is now the UDC insisting on transparency, while the IEC is saying, no, we don't believe in transparency. That is where we are right now. This is what the August case is all about.
So what's the next step for the UDC?
We are studying the whole situation, and then we'll decide on the way forward. You know, there have been a number of suggestions. People have been saying, let us have mass demonstrations, let us mobilize the people, you know, to peacefully raise these issues against the government. Because generally, Botswana do not believe that these issues should be resolved amicably. The major problem that we have is a ruling party that has lost all form of credibility and does not accept that it is no longer does no longer enjoy the support of the people, and we will do anything to ensure that they become victorious by a hook or crook in the next elections.
Moeti Mawasa is the spokesperson for the opposition UDC. He spoke with me from the Botswana capital, Habaroni. In Guinea-Bissau, President Umaro Sissoco Embalo has taken a decisive action in the political arena, dismissing Prime Minister Geraldo Martins just a week after reinstating him. Martins initially assumed the role in August but was ousted earlier this month when President Embalo dissolved the government following a thwarted coup attempt in December. In a surprising turn of events, a presidential decree issued on Wednesday revealed that Rui Duarte de Barros, who previously served as the transitional Prime Minister of Guinea-Bissau from 2012 to 2014, will be the new appointee. For the latest development, I reach Alberto Dabo. He is a journalist based in the Guinea-Bissau capital, Bissau.
President Sissoco has formed his government because he said that it was a presidential initiative. He said that it will not be a government of PAIGC nor from PRS or another party, but it is a cabinet of presidential initiative. It's what Sissoco said. It is that government who has been inaugurated today at 9 a.m. here in Guinea-Bissau.
What does it mean by the statement that is a presidential initiative? What does that mean?
This means that this government has been formed by his own initiative because of that coup d'etat attempt. The coup d'etat attempt we have experienced on 1st of December. It was an attempt to subvert the constitutional order in Guinea-Bissau. That's why Sissoko took the decision to dissolve first the parliament and then to dissolve the cabinet. And because of this coup d'etat attempt, that's why Sissoko says that now, from now, he will create his own government and all, you understand, the members of that cabinet will give him reports about what they have to do about all decisions they have to do in their exercise.
Will this government be legal, especially when the former Speaker of Parliament said it was illegal to dissolve Parliament and all that, and they are threatening to protest to make sure that that illegality, as they said, is reversed?
As everybody know here in Guinea-Bissau, and as people know in the international community, this cabinet created by the president is not legal. Because Domingo Simões Pereira, who is the president of the Party of Independence for Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, says that this is an unconstitutional government, because normally you can't dissolve the parliament if the parliament does not exist during 12 months. Sissoko dissolved the parliament when it was existing at its fourth month. And then, as we know, this cabinet is illegal. Sissoko said today during the inauguration of this new government that whoever is not satisfied of what he has done, he can file a complaint at the Supreme Court of Guinea-Bissau. For him, he does not care about what the people are saying in Guinea-Bissau about the unconstitutionality of this cabinet, and he doesn't care also what the people are saying at the international community level. For him, if you are not satisfied, you can file a complaint at the Supreme Court of Guinea-Bissau.
Alberto Dabo is a journalist who spoke with me from the Guinea-Bissau capital, Bissau. The recent clashes between two army factions in the capital, Bissau, during President Mbalo's absence at the UN's COP28 climate conference in Dubai added another layer of complexity to the country's political landscape. In a further move, President Mbalo has formed a new government, assigning the fight against corruption to the head of the new team, Rui Duarte Barros. This development comes amid a crisis marked by the dissolution of the assembly and clashes that President Mbalo labeled a coup attempt. But critics say his actions contravene the constitution. Opponents say they plan to launch a legal challenge as they continue to pressure him to rescind the decision to organize fresh parliamentary elections. Political observers are proposing key measures to resolve the ongoing political challenges facing Guinea-Bissau. These include preventing top military officials from interfering in politics, forcing military officers over the age limit to retire, and maintaining ECOWAS standby force.
This week on Straight Talk Africa, we speak with the creator of a unique documentary that sheds light on the ongoing humanitarian crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo. VOA executive producer Omari Kaseko takes us into Goma. Join me, Heidi Adams, for an intimate look at the silent war that has been going on for years on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
In Senegal, the governing Socialist Party has officially nominated Prime Minister Amadou Ba as its candidate to lead it in the presidential contest in February's general election. His nomination comes after outgoing President Macky Sall announced he was not seeking a third term. Analysts say that decision and his backing of his prime minister could give Ba a significant boost in the presidential contest. But they also warn that voters in Senegal have a history of choosing opposition candidates to lead the country. For more reaction and analysis, I reach Christopher Ogumodede, who is based in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. He is a consultant and foreign affairs analyst who specializes in West African politics, security, and foreign relations.
Well, it's not a surprise. As far as the elections go, Macky Sall announced that he wouldn't be seeking a third term, to the relief of practically everybody in Senegal, I guess, you know, except perhaps for his supporters, and certainly in terms of the so-called international community, you know, the West. The question then became who would succeed Macky Sall. And to that question, there wasn't so much of a clear answer. You know, so that's where Amadou Ba came in as the incumbent prime minister, someone who Macky Sall, I guess, had some confidence in, if nothing else, as a technocrat, as the head of government. As I say, there wasn't a clear successor in mind for Macky Sall. Many people believe, with some good reason, that he did want to stay on in power.
What do you say to those who are of the view that Amadou Ba's choice as a Senegalese prime minister is a way of the outgoing President Macky Sall to pull the strings behind the scenes?
I don't see it that way, you know. In reality, politics tends not to work that way for the simple reason that no one likes to be a lackey. No one likes to be a lapdog. No one likes to be told what to do. Even when, and there are countless examples I can cite of people believing that one guy is handing over to someone who he believes will be his lapdog, only for that person to get power, and it doesn't turn out that way. So I'm inclined not to view things that way. It's hard for any person with any sense of worth to be thought of as a lackey and be content with it to be that way. So even if Macky Sall wants it to be that way, it will almost certainly not play out that way. Amadou Ba, should he win the presidency, will have his own constituency, will have his own interests, will have his own preferences, will have a different political scenario to deal with, will also have a whole range of international context to deal with. So that kind of pulling the strings argument is not one I tend to buy into.
Christopher, critics of the president are saying that the ruling party appears to see the threat that detained opposition leader Ousmane Sonko could pose, possibly to the ambitions of the ruling party to maintain power. And that is why he's being dragged all over the place. Your thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. I tend to agree with them, you know, if for no other reason than the fact that the first two dry runs, if you will, you know, the municipal elections as well as the legislative elections in 2022, last year, the Ousmane Sonko's coalition, you know, performed very well. You know, Ousmane Sonko is actually the mayor of Ziguinchor, which was captured by the opposition. Dakar is dominated by the opposition. Many other cities and towns are dominated by the opposition. As I'm sure you are aware of, the large-scale protests that have, you know, engulfed the country really over since 2021, that speaks to a certain amount of momentum, especially among the overwhelmingly young population, because, you know, Senegal, like most West African countries, is incredibly young. And that is the core of Ousmane Sonko's support among the young people in the cities and towns. So I will not be, you know, I'd be remiss not to speak to the formidability of Ousmane Sonko's candidacy. And the ruling party recognizes this, which is why it's tried every way possible to, at minimum, curb his ability to rally support among the people in the cities and towns. But the difficulty they've had in doing so is that Ousmane Sonko's support permeates well beyond, you know, the ability to mobilize people physically. So even when they've barred physical demonstrations and gatherings and, you know, confined him to his home, people have still been out there supporting him. So yes, yeah, the idea that Sonko presents a challenge to the ruling party is real, yes.
Christopher Ogumodede is a consultant and foreign affairs analyst who specializes in West African politics, security, and foreign relations. He is based in the Senegalese capital, Dakar. In Sierra Leone, the Campaign for Human Rights and Development is welcoming the administration's decision to lift the curfew following the recent coup attempt. The rights group had petitioned the authorities to lift the measure a week after its imposition, arguing that it was a legal restriction on citizens. It comes after the government imposed the curfew and launched an investigation to those responsible for the coup attempt. Several people have been arrested while police say former President Ernest Bai Koroma is a criminal suspect. He is currently under house arrest following days of interrogation in the capital, Freetown. For more reaction to the decision to lift the curfew, I reach Abdul Fatoma. He is the Executive Director of Campaign for Human Rights and Development.
We welcome the government gesture in terms of respecting the right of citizens in this country. After the 7 days, we deem the curfew as a legal restriction on movement of citizens and residents in Sierra Leone. And we stated that the current practice by the government by then does not draw from either best practice or neither any of the international law. We urge them, if they want to continue with a state of emergency, it needs to go through Parliament and Parliament to give them that right. And then we also need a regulation. So when people are arrested, they should know how long they're going to be detained or what are some of their fines or otherwise. So government adhering to the call of civil society and other citizens in Sierra Leone, I mean, it's a welcoming thing. It shows that they're listening to the people of this country.
Well, Abdul, does that mean that tensions as a result of the attempted coup eased so far in Sierra Leone, for which reason the government decided to lift the curfew?
People are going about with their normal businesses, and businesses are open since the 27th. But then that doesn't mean that the government is not still putting a lot of effort in investigating the matter, because they keep updating the wanted list and they have increased the amount they want to give as a reward to people who can help you lead to the, you know, arrest of, you know, the people that are on the wanted list. And there are still military checkpoints, night, hour, daytime. You know, when you're traveling out of Freetown, it's actually challenging for so many people, like disabled people. They have to get down, you know, without wheelchair or other mobilities and stand in a queue for like half an hour. These are also challenges, but the security sector, I mean, they are still busy to investigate this matter. And the thing is that now the former flag bearer, you know, has been called to the Anti-Corruption Commission. Last night there was a rumor that he was actually detained, but he was not. But the Anti-Corruption Commission said they granted him a bail. So these are all still tensions, you know, because it links to political, you know, activities in this country, because political supporters see the arrest of their leaders, either it's for corruption or attempted coup. I mean, they are not paying keen attention about the other side of the rule of law, or what they think about is more political things. So those things actually bring tension to the community.
I understand the Minister of Information and Civic Education confirmed the payment to individuals who helped the police in capturing the runaway fugitives in relation to the November 26 attempted coup in the country. How are people reacting to this?
The thing is that these allegations are not strange. 2 or 3 years ago back, there were similar allegations that the McKinney riots was sponsored by former president and some other senior APC people. And that was the allegation around at the Panemba Road prison break 3 years ago. It was a similar allegation. The Tombo riot, you know, it was similar allegations that, you know, they have evidence there. We didn't see much outcome of that investigation. So basically, now investigation is ongoing and the minister is not giving some of the pieces of findings from the security on the investigation. I think the public think that they're trying to put a cat before the horse. For now, everyone presumed to be innocent until found guilty by a competent court of law. And that is the due process. That's the rule of law. I think the president talked about that this investigation will go through, you know, a due process. And his government will respect the rule of law. And so we want the government to respect due process. And let's see, when once these things are in court, then it becomes a public information.
Abdul Fatoma is the Executive Director of Campaign for Human Rights and Development. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, and right now it's time for music from our collection.
But the fire is so delightful, and since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. Man, it doesn't show signs of stopping, and I brought me some corn for popping. The lights are turned way down low, let it snow, let it snow. When we finally kiss goodnight, how I'll hate going out in the storm. But if you really hold me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. And the fire is slowly dying, and my dear, we're still goodbying. But as long as you'd love me so, let it snow, let it snow and snow. We finally kiss goodnight, how I'll hate going out in the storm. But if you really grab me tight, all the way home I'll be warm. Oh, the fire is slowly dying, and my dear, we're still goodbye. But as long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
And that was music from our collection. We hope you enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer Al Santos, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a piece of gold that wants to shine must first pass through the fire. I'm your host, Peter Clotin, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.
Oh, we're walking. Listen, in the meadow we can build a snowman and pretend that he is parson Brown. He'll say, I am mad, we'll say no. But you can do the job.
your face unafraid. Plans that we made, walking in the winds, wonderland, walking in the winds.